The next contestant, the world of showbiz seems a million miles away.
It's Paul, a mobile phone salesman from South Wales.
By day, I sell mobile phones. My dream is to spend my life doing what I feel that I was born to do.
Paul, what are you here for today, Paul?
To sing opera. I've always wanted to sing as a career. Confidence has always been sort of like a difficult thing for me. I've always found it a little bit difficult to be completely confident in myself.
Okay, ready when you are.
It's now 15 years since then mobile phone salesman Paul Potts left audiences agape following his wonderful performance on Britain's Got Talent. It's now one of the most watched auditions in YouTube history. And Paul, who of course went on to be crowned winner of the first ever Britain's Got Talent, has never looked back since then. He's since gone on to sell over 5 million albums and have a Hollywood movie made of his life story. And I'm delighted to say that Paul Potts is with us now. Good morning to you, Paul.
Good morning. How are you?
Very well. Thanks very much for joining us. And I'm sure you have relived that and heard that audio and that your audition on Britain's Got Talent many times. But I just wonder, this far removed and with all the water that has passed under your bridge since then, you know, the career that you now have, what does listening to that feel like? Is it like listening to, you know, a different person almost?
Well, it makes me feel old. I was in my mid thirties then. I'm closer to my mid fifties now, so it's nostalgic in certain ways. But it kind of has two emotions to me. It's there's a bit melancholy about it because it's something that I'll never have that moment again in that way. But also, winning Britain's Got Talent, it's something they can never take away from me. No matter what happens, they can never take that away. So it's not exactly bittersweet. It's just there's two sides to it.
Yeah, and I mean, like, I remember watching it at the time, and what amazed me was, and clearly I was wrong, because I looked at you and I thought, God, this guy looks nervous. But then you started to sing, I was like, oh, wow, I got that completely wrong. I mean, you'd obviously been an opera buff or passionate about that music for years and had been singing for years, so you knew quite well you were going to be able to handle that occasion, because there's we see a lot of auditions on the X Factor and Britain's Got Talent, and sadly the nerves can get the better of people, but not with you.
Well, I was nervous. I was looking for an exit sign just before I'd come on, because there was a couple that was on. There was a couple from Bristol that were basically the woman was dancing with a pashmina scarf and her husband was whistling birdsong, and they got booed off, and I thought, oh my God, what am I letting myself in for? And I thought, well, I don't even, because at the time I didn't know whether they'd let me use a backing track, because they weren't telling us we couldn't, but they were discouraging us from using them, because of course they had to pay for the use. So I was asked by one of the crew whether I was okay, and I said, well, I'd be a lot happier if I could use my backing track, and said, do you have it with you? I said, yeah. Track 7 under the CD, and I was then able to perform with the backing track, which left me feeling a lot more comfortable than I would have been had I had to perform a cappella.
And I guess given the audience's reaction, you knew you'd done well, and you went on to win the series. And you know, how quickly following your success on Britain's Got Talent, Paul, did your career, your now career as an opera singer begin? You know, we see winners of these competitions who, you know, be it X Factor or Britain's Got Talent, will put out a single or maybe an album. And some acts have gone on to have long careers, you know, you think of One Direction and so on, and yourself. Others, it doesn't go any further than that. So how quickly did the momentum gather for you and keep you where you are now?
Well, I think that a lot of people have done these shows. Most of them are still performing. And if that's what they aim to get out of the performance, then they're still successful in my view. Because there's more to a career in music than always being in the public eye. But it kind of grew really quickly for me, and you just have to try and take each day as it comes, or else it can overwhelm you. And I still have that attitude now. I know that, you know, I get to do what I love doing because people are continuing to buy tickets to watch me perform and buying my CDs, and without them buying my music, I wouldn't have the career that I have, and I wouldn't be traveling as much as I am now. So I'm very flattered, not flattered. I'm very fortunate to be able to do what makes me, which for me is the biggest definition of what success is.
Your voice is amazing, but opera, maybe rightly or wrongly, maybe it's viewed as a type of music, and the kind of there'd be traditionalists within that. And, you know, the avenue through which you became an opera singer, did you ever face any kind of blowback in terms of or resistance from diehard opera fans or maybe other opera singers or musicians who, you know, who had come up the more traditional way to become well-known opera singers?
Well, not so much from opera singers themselves, but there's been some pushback from critics. But these are the same critics, though, that say that so-called crossover music doesn't bring people to listen to proper, in inverted commas, classical music. Except that's not true, because that's how I got to listen to classical music and opera, was from watching films and the film scores, which are very much a crossover from something that's popular into more classical music. If it hadn't have been for John Williams' soundtrack to E.T. and Star Wars, I would never have listened to Tchaikovsky, Dvorak and Brahms. And then I wouldn't then start to listen to the choral stuff and the vocal stuff that come from opera, by Puccini and Verdi, etc.
Yeah, and I mean, look, you haven't looked back. You've released 6 studio albums. There's been a greatest hits. As I say, 5 million albums sold. Over 1,000 performances across 45 countries. Do you tend to do lengthy tours?
They can be quite lengthy. I mean, I'm looking at my schedule for the rest of the year, and I think I'm home for 3 days between now and December the 17th. So, and this does tend to be the busiest time of my year, from the autumn up to Christmas, because I tour Germany and Denmark pretty much annually, and I'm normally in Korea 3, 4, maybe 5 times a year, and I'm leaving for Korea tomorrow. So it keeps me busy, and it's great to be able to put out new music, and also it's great sometimes to do sort of private performances at home that, you know, to get streamed across to people, which is how my latest album got made.
Yeah, and the album itself, I mean, I've talked to a lot of musicians on the show who, you know, lockdown, COVID presented challenges in terms of touring, but it was a chance for a lot of them to record and just start writing, and you know, it was a kind of a fruitful period for them in terms of writing. And it appears to have been the case for you, because the new album, Music and Unprohibited, Music is Not Forbidden, is, and I'm as a fan of music myself, I love double albums. They were all seen as very much a thing of the 70s, you know, or maybe like the White Album by the Beatles. Some people, you know, kind of feel, oh well, there could be filler on double albums, but I love them because I think there's more of a journey. And it is a double album that you've gone for. How long did that take to come together, and when did you decide, wow, there's enough here to turn this into more than one record?
Well, I initially intended 12 to 16 tracks to fit it onto one CD, but because basically it's based on a lot of the lockdown performance that I did during the first lockdown in 2020, and I did about 200 odd different pieces, and of course I can't record them all, but So I thought 12 to 16, I got to the studio, started recording. Then I thought, well, I'm going to have to think about what I'm doing. And then in the end, I ended up recording 41. Of course, they don't put them to one CD. So, and even when I finished, I had to jiggle things around a bit, because although you can fit more data onto a CD, you cannot put any more than 80 minutes onto a CD. Apparently, the length of the CD is based on the Ninth Symphony by Beethoven, which is normally 80 minutes long. And it just won't allow anything more than 80 minutes. So I had to jiggle the running order as well. Because when I record an album, it's me that decides the running order. And I tried to think of it like it's a performance. So each CD had to have a flow, like you were at a concert, and, you know, the light and shade, quicker pieces, slower pieces, bigger pieces, softer pieces, and to try and blend them in so that, you know, you can listen to it as a body of work.
Some of the musicians I've spoken to, Paul, chose to view lockdown as to see the positives in it, and particularly you're mentioning, you know, the latter quarter of this year, you're only going to be at home for 3 days, and given the way your career took off like a rocket from 2007 on, and, you know, as I mentioned, the amount of concerts you've performed, was this the, you know, did you welcome it in certain ways, that it was an opportunity to be at home with the family and work at a more serene pace?
It did enable me to spend more time at home. It does leave you wondering what's going to happen next, and I think there's still a certain amount of uncertainty in the arts, because, you know, people don't know what's going to happen later in the year when other variants may come along, and people are booking tickets a lot later than they would normally, so there's a lot of uncertainty. But it was great to spend time with family, and I think the lockdown made people exercise more as well. I think people walked more, because there was this feeling that you couldn't do something. If you had been told you couldn't do something, you fought for your right to be able to do it. And so, you know, I think a lot of people that wouldn't normally go out for an hour-long walk went for an hour-long walk, because it was something they were allowed to do when they weren't allowed to do anything else.
Yeah, it was good. We were starved of things to do. So it was like suddenly a walk became the most exciting thing in our lives.
Zoom gyms and etc.
Yeah. The new album, Paul. I mean, once you're touring again, I mean, how do you approach set lists? Because, I mean, your gigs for the rest of the year and into next year, I mean, you could literally be doing concerts based entirely around music Don Braibada.
Well, I kind of mix in some all the albums that I do, but I also do things that I haven't recorded yet, because they're a great way of trying things out with an audience to see if they'd enjoy a particular piece. And I always deliberately do things that aren't necessarily that well known, because I sometimes find that musically we can get a bit lazy, and it's something that the media is responsible for to a degree, because when you see things like Britain's Got Talent or similar things, and any kind of show where there's a performance, they'll always want you to do something that people have heard. And I think there's this sense of familiarity that's kind of required, when actually people should be experiencing new music and not see that as a negative thing, that it's something they haven't heard before. And I think this is how we've ended up with people like Ed Sheeran getting accused of plagiarism, because he's having to keep things familiar. And so it's very difficult to write completely new music. You've only got 13 notes to deal with. It's amazing we've got the music that we have. And so I think people are always looking for a certain familiarity. So it's good to do stuff sometimes that people don't know yet, and just to allow people to immerse themselves in new music.
Do you have that issue as well, where if you're coming up with stuff, there's elements of the classic seeping into it? Although I guess you're in a different situation than Ed, where, you know, he has faced issues from other songwriters. Whereas if you've unintentionally plagiarised somebody, they died in the 17th century, so they're not liable to be looking for money from you.
I'm not someone that composes music, so that it's not an issue for me at all. Because there's this with people like me, you know, we generally only do cover songs.
Yeah. So. An issue you're not going to encounter.
But you can, I mean, you can put words to a tune that that didn't happen originally. There's a few of those that do in the rounds.
Are, in terms of next year, then, I mean, have you, you know what you're doing up to just before Christmas. How far ahead is your career and life mapped out, Paul?
Well, we're already in discussions. Well, I've got a UK tour in February, March next year, and it's looking like I may be going down under as well at some point. And there will be more trips to Korea and more trips to Germany and possibly Switzerland and Austria as well. So it's keep getting busy, but hopefully we won't have too many because we were delayed coming back from Germany because there was a problem with the engine. So I ended up spending 24 hours further in Germany, which meant I lost another day at home. But these things happen, and it doesn't happen very often.
Okay, it sounds like you're getting around a lot of places. Hopefully you'll be paying us a visit here in Ireland at some stage.
I'd love to come again. It's I played Cork and Dublin and also Castlebar a few years back, and there's some great theatres. The Opera House in Cork's fantastic, and I played the Olympia in Dublin, which is a beautiful theatre.
Okay, lovely stuff, and no doubt your fans will be delighted when you do come back. Just before I let you go, Paul, of course, a movie was made about your life. I was trying to think if someone approached me and said, we want to make a film about your life, I mean, would I be flattered, or, you know, would I say, well, I want to have control over it? I mean, how did you feel when they came knocking and said, can we make a film about your life story? Were you delighted? Did you have any kind of say over what went into it? And I guess it being Hollywood, were there elements of your life they had to dramatise?
Well, it's Hollywood, so they're going to dramatise something, because they've got to squeeze things into a certain time period. So there are always going to be things that they kind of crunch together, of the locations that they change, and because it's like they didn't show me being in Bristol, because there was no dramatic need to do that in certain ways, and to have more locations would just cause confusion. So they did make certain changes, but I kind of left them to it, because there's nothing like being watched doing what you're doing. And I hate being watched from reversing into a parking spot. So,
yeah, don't be all.
They won't be saying, no, it didn't happen like that. It's I wanted the film to be something that was joyous, and I wanted it to be a comedy. I didn't want it to be a blow-by-blow docudrama, because, you know, there's plenty of stuff like that that can be done. And it's great that the message of not giving up gets put over in a way that doesn't feel like tautology, that it doesn't feel like you're being taught something.
James Corden, of course, did a great job in the film, but I wonder, like most men, you know, when that hypothetical question of who would play you in the movie of your life, did you ask for Brad Pitt?
There were a few suggestions for people to play me. I'm glad they picked the British version. There was a suggestion of Kevin Hart, not Kevin Hart. That would be completely wrong. I'm terrible with names here.
I know the guy you're on, but the guy who's in The King of Queens.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can't think of his name either.
He did Paul Blatt, Molkoff as well. Yeah. And I'm terrible with names. I'd have to Google it. I'll remember it when I don't need to. But they had two options: to go the full American way or to keep it British. And I'm glad they kept it British. But they're always going to make certain changes. I mean, one scene that did get dropped that I was really gutted about, because it was hilarious. There was a scene with James in a clown suit, sat at the back of a bus, not feeling quite sorry for himself. And then over the top was played Tears of a Clown. And the timing of it was just perfect. It was hilarious. But I suspect that probably the what they would have had to pay Smokey Robinson was probably too much. And I think it was probably a budget reason that meant that I hit the curtain room floor. And it's a real pity, because it was hilarious when I watched that.
Yeah, that sounds great. That's a shame. But sure, look, the film is still great regardless. The new album, it's a double album, Musica Non Prohibita. Keep an eye out for it. Music is not forbidden. Paul, it's been an absolute pleasure chatting with you, and the best of luck with the rest of the year. You're going to be a busy boy, and hopefully we'll see you again in Ireland.
I look forward to it. Take care.
Thanks so much. That's Paul Potts there with us on Morning Focus. It is 0818 400 964 to give us a call, or you can text or WhatsApp us on 086 1800 964.